Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, retired trauma surgeon David Halpin from South Dartmoor. He talks about the National Health Service, what he sees as being dismantled, the European Union, and he's an expert on the death of Dr. David Kelly, the government scientist who was murdered, potentially, although some say it was suicide, in 2003 at the time of the Iraq War. In fact, David was one of the people that helped get the inquiry into David Kelly's death to be taken more seriously. Also, Bristolian V. Townsend has been in the national news, a vegan told by NatWest that all vegans should be punched in the face. Incredibly, you'll find quite a lot of reporting of that in the national newspapers. We have her and her story for you. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
I'm David Halpin. I'm a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon. I've been retired about 20 years, a bit less actually. And I have woods, which give me peace, and a lovely garden, which I look after. And I think all the time, can't stop thinking, and I'm deeply worried about our country, our NHS in particular, and my focus is especially on the Middle East and Palestine, right at the middle. And as they say, if there's no peace in Palestine, there will be no peace in the Middle East. And if there's no peace in the Middle East, there will be no peace in the world. That's exactly it. That's the words of a Palestinian lady, the hospital superintendent.
Now, David, I think many people are looking at Brexit. They're focusing on specific aspects, but very few are really looking at the way that Brussels has affected the National Health Service. There is an attempt to try and homogenise all the EU members very slowly. I mean, for example, there's different VAT rates in different countries for different things, but slowly but surely they're trying to get it all as one. In what way, if at all, has the EU affected the NHS in this country?
Well, two obvious ways. One is by promoting the neoliberal ideology. It's a poor word, neoliberal. And the other obvious way is through European competition laws. Well exemplified by the way Prime Minister Major, in privatising the railways, which we, of course, invented the permanent way, they separated the wheels from the track. And you know, when you have to look at what's been happening throughout the privatisation of the railways, or from it, to see what a disaster that has been in terms of coordinated service, which was affordable to many. So those are the two obvious things. But I think, in fact, it's really the making capital the most important thing, and promoting the idea that private is good and public is bad. So the health service, which was conceived by, it came out of many people, probably, but one was the liberal, just forget his name for a moment, and then was Nye Bevan, who set it in motion. In that first year, the budget was £3 billion. It's now £120 billion. And it was done in spite of a national debt of over 200%. And people don't know that when they're being told they can't afford it. All the middle-class people around where I'm living, in a rather nice part in the edge of Dartmoor, some of them say, we cannot afford the NHS. I see red when I see that, when I think of two aircraft carriers, which are attack weapons. They're only useful in aggressive wars, not in defending our country. I see red, because that's what we're dealing with, blind dogma and nitwit people, nitwits, adhering to it.
Now, David, I wonder, if you look back at how the NHS came out of the Second World War, yes. I mean, it really was, I think, in many people's minds, that the last thing you want to do when you're dragging someone out of a burning building is to check their documents to make sure they've got health insurance. So isn't there some sort of connection between the experience of the Blitz and the way that this idea, when it was floated in the 1945 general election by the Labour Party, that people got behind it?
Well, I think it was generally, it was a general. It was a sea change, really. An officer class were not so prominent in the Second World War as they were in the First, over-the-top men. There were 3 million people to be demobbed at the end of World War II. That's a hell of a lot of people. And a lot of them came from very humble origins. They'd got together with other people. They'd seen the medical service in the Second World War working superbly without vast tiers of administrators and politicians telling them what to do, just doctors and nurses and other people doing their best for wounded soldiers. So there was, it was in fact an example of groupthink, really. They could see what was possible, and they weren't going to have the conditions which were existing before the Second World War, like a lady I knew in Totten, is now dead, who was a great enthusiast for Morning Star, as was I. She used to share her shoes. There were six in the family, very poor dwelling in North London. Father was a carpenter, and forget her name now, she was a lovely person. She shared her shoes with a sister. So one day, the sister went to school with her shoes. The next day, she went to school with the shoes. And that's the sort of thing. And she saw one of her brothers dying of meningitis in the home. So that wasn't long ago, was it, Tony? That's what, only 70 years ago?
Well, though, many of those people, of course, many of those people now are dead, or there's only a few left that can actually remember that experience.
And they weren't listened to, really, but you know what they used to do. Another person told me that they would have a shilling on the mantelpiece, and if there were two sick children, they'd have to work out the parents, which was the sickest, to pay the GP. People have to think of that and to think how now they don't have to worry. They're worrying now about waiting lists and poor service and inadequate standards as people flee the health service, the staff, I mean. But they don't. They haven't had to think too much. Just to enlarge on that, there's a website in the States which looks at average costs of medicine in the States, and all the delivery, which they title vaginal delivery rather crudely, $12,000. The Caesar, which happens in 20% of cases of ladies in this country, of mothers, $40,000. They don't know that, and they cannot conceive it. And their minds, most of them, I'm afraid to say, are in limbo, as they're distracted by the junk, the entertainment put out by the BBC.
Well, yes, but many people will point out, David, you, as a Brexiteer, are actually framing your criticism of the way that health is run in this country around the agenda of being for Brexit. So there's lots of people like Boris would probably agree with you for a change about the NHS.
You mean there's a right-wing agenda?
Well, there are many people who will see anything and pick anything they can to say, well, we need to have a Brexit because it will help the NHS. Boris has said that.
Oh, yes, I know. You mean the $38 billion which we pay to the, which we donate to the European Union, will be redirected by Mr. Boris Johnson and the rest of the right-wingers in the Tory party, having destroyed the Labour Party by all sorts of means, but especially by the anti-Semitic slur directed at Corbyn in particular. No, I agree. There's an element of that, an element of truth in that. There will be some more. There will be some taxation available for public service in this country, but it depends upon the people running it. And I should add this, Tony, that I said for about 20 years that the NHS must be disconnected from the government of the day. They come in, they always have a new idea, and we get their dogma time after time. I've seen about 8 convulsions in the health service as a surgeon, doctor, and almost all of them been harmful to the service. So there must be a national executive, very carefully chosen, not placemen, Freemasons, and the rest of them, but people, executive of experts, the people of the best intent, principled people, and they report. They get a budget. The government is responsible just for inspection, say, or things like that, perhaps public health, maybe not public health, but the executive reports to the House of Commons, to the people. I know that's defective in all sorts of ways at the moment, but we must get away from the NHS being treated as a political football. Labour used it, Tories have used it, you know, safe in our hands. Was that Cameron? That's what we're dealing with.
Is it safe in Conservative hands?
No, not at all. It's not even safe in Labour hands. During the regime, at the end of the, you always use the word regime about Syria and Venezuela in a pejorative way, the BBC et al. During the Blair regime, this man being a paramount psychopath and war criminal, it wasn't safe in their hands. They're also neoliberals. And they don't believe in socialized medicine, really. And in Labour time, they built surgical treatment centres, I think it was STCs they were called. There's one in Plymouth, around the country with public money. One in Plymouth now, this is very instructive. The first, when they kicked off, they were doing hip replacement, things like that. The Italian surgeon in charge, not perhaps very long trained, I don't know, not sure about that. But he said after the first year, their infection rate for total hip replacements was 4%. Disastrous. The team, it wasn't a team of surgeons, you know, talking to each other and having meetings. It was one from Sweden, one from Germany, one from Poland, one from Italy, that sort of thing. But you know what's happened now? Dereford, which is the largest hospital in England, I understand, talk about the satanic mills, this big chimney. They have decanted, they have directed, they have diverted all orthopedic operations to this surgical treatment centre, into the care of Care UK, I think it is, one of the private companies. So there won't be any sort of corporate orthopedic feeling in Plymouth. It'll be all sort of, you know, diverted here, there and everywhere. But they may do some operations like club foot.
Yes, but I mean, if they can do it as cheap or cheaper than the National Health Service, surely that's a good thing.
No, it isn't. It's a rotten thing. The thing is that all these things, it's not, this is one of my favourite, one of my expressions among many, it is not quick fit tires. You need people of the highest integrity, of the best training. I qualified from St. Mary's, thank God, it was a good medical school, in 1964. I didn't become a consultant in orthopedic and trauma surgery until 1975, 11 years later, at Torbay and at the Orthopaedic Hospital in Exeter, which is now a housing estate. Another, I can't remember if it was Labour or Tory, it was Tory actually. They erased a first-class single specialty hospital which could do steady work, four theatres, day after day after day, not on Saturdays, could have done that as well. I think it did eventually. But they erased that because now they are concentrated, the surgeons. There were five then, there are now 33. And in February this year, there were 33 surgeons working from 12 beds. So you can imagine how many women, usually women, were on the phone telling patients that they were unfortunately being put back a few months or whatever, and they'd be phoned again and the rest of it. There are legions of people now in the health service just spending time telling patients they're being postponed.
I mean, you've seen the whole process, really, haven't you? Britain joining the common market. We had that happened in 1973 under Ted Heath, who was a bit of a dubious prime minister, but nevertheless he signed us in with no vote or anything. And then in 1975, Harold Wilson, the Labour prime minister, allowed a referendum on the decision, and we decided that time to remain. And you've also lived through this experience in 2016. In June, where the British public voted to leave what is now the EU. Of course, we originally joined something called the Common Market, but it's transmogrified into something very much more political, where they're now talking about even a union of the armed forces, never mind euro and the currency union. So what have you seen transformed over that period of time? And to what extent, sorry to interrupt again, but to what extent can we actually really blame that on Brussels? And maybe it's just maladministration here too.
No, I think it's they're thinking alike. The Merkels and the Mays and people are very much alike in their so-called policies. And thinking back to when I qualified, we couldn't do so much, Tony, then, but there was a great spirit in the hospitals. There's a tremendous concentration on diagnosis skills in that, and on surgery as well. It was a simple environment. There was a hospital governor of St. Mary's and a few people in the office. That was it. I went to Torbay in 75. There was a very good manager there, administrator, I forget what his title was. It's probably secretary. There was a hospital management committee. There would be patrician Tories on that who were as enthusiastic and as devoted to the health service as any socialist, in my view, because they knew it mattered and it was part of the, hate that word, community. It was part of that. It has changed, and it's become partly it's orthopedic surgery. Orthopedic, I had a private practice, but my main job was in NHS, and I've spoken for the NHS for years and years, going back particularly to 1988, internal market of Thatcher. But when I qualified, I cannot think that money was in my mind at all. It was because I felt privileged. I just loved medicine, what I was doing, and laser surgery. And that's all it was. And you'll find the same with nurses. They just liked nursing. They had salaries, but they weren't magical. My salary when I first qualified as a mayor was £48 a month. It paid the rent of our flat in Chiswick. Now, I wasn't complaining about that because I loved it. And a lot of other people did as well. Now, the love bit, they've taken out of it. It's become, they have tons of protocols to follow in the ICU, this, that, and the other. I said to a consultant in ICU, who lives quite locally, no name, no pack drill, he was asking about mistakes, you know, how do you keep things safe? And I said, the most important thing is morale. Well, the morale is rock bottom, I'm told. And it's rock bottom if you know that the patient you sent for is being cancelled. And if you can't do the operation which you were gearing up to do because it was difficult. So things have changed dramatically. And what I would say, there's been a principle. And our spirit, it's the spirit that's been eroded. And there's a very good quotation from a book by a fellow of Jewish origin. His family were Berlin Jews. They got out in 1936 to America. He was a journalist. He wrote a good book called 1938-45, The Germans, They Thought They Were Free. And there's some quotations from that book. I never read the book, actually, to be honest about it. But the quotations are absolutely apt. Well, I said to people, I say, this is Britain now. Things change surreptitiously. You don't see it. Like he says in these quotations, the farmer doesn't see the wheat growing. You don't see it. But it's happened. And what has happened is a spirit, the spirit of collegiality. There are influences like that. Look at online marketing as a good example. Things like that. But you think of the European Union, it isn't about the good and about people being able to express themselves and do their best for their neighbours and for their country. It's about war. The EU is the soft side of NATO, with the US over the waters driving it. So NATO backed the decimation of Yugoslavia. It's backed, it keeps quiet on the torture, the crucifixion of the Palestinian people. It makes a few gestures, sends a few things out, water tanks or whatever, but doesn't do anything practical about it, solid about it. And it's the same with Iraq. Coalition of the 39, wasn't it? I think when they started bombing Iraq and destroying that country and many of its people. Libya, Syria, the same. So it's not a good setup.
Well, some people will say the opposite. They'll say, well, some of the main countries like France and Germany and Italy have actually pushed back against NATO and against the Americans.
Rubbish.
And the British, no?
Rubbish. There's no pushback at all. Well, look at Venezuela. I sent a piece to the Inflation Clearinghouse. It's about the BBC, the most potent state propagandist, and they published it. So what? So they should. Michel Klosodowski, the chief editor, put it up. Venezuela, who is in fact backing Guaido, who they say is a CIA creature, wouldn't be surprised. They've had sanctions there from America. Sanctions, in fact, are an act of war, as they are against Iran. And the sanctions have been, US sanctions have been going there since 2015.
Let me quickly ask you about the whole David Kelly business, because there's just been another book out on that, hasn't there? And I know you had something to do with, you were one of the people who was protesting, really, about him almost certainly not having committed suicide. Can you just tell us in a nutshell, what's the latest on that?
There's no latest, really. There are some extra facts which Miles Goldsmith has elicited, and which is in his paperback version. The title is The Inconvenient Death of Dr. Kelly, then there's a colon, and I forget the rest, but that's the first part of the title. And it's a good book, good books, the paperback and the previous one, the hardback. But I'm afraid that certain things are omitted, which are very important indeed, which suggested to my mind that Kelly was like, on the loose cannon, but he was about to spill the beans. And he was spilling the beans, this is very important, when in May 2003, when they'd found no weapons of mass destruction, Blair's pretext for the war, and the public were against the war anyway, in a majority, I believe, and things were sinking. It was getting more unpopular as the war went on in those first 2 months. And Kelly made some observations, which are in on Global Research, written by me, the evidence of his daughter Rachel, and it's very important evidence. It suggests that he was speaking his mind, and they don't want people speaking their mind, because it would have shown that the whole thing was a sham, and a terrible sham for the poor people of Iraq, who'd been shredded and killed, and the water supplies and all the rest destroyed.
Now, David, if you whereabouts is the best place to read your articles and follow your work?
Well, my website is, if you Google the website of David Halpin, that's one thing, it's H-A-L-P-I-N. And also on Global Research, there's about 35 papers of mine, essays or pieces, articles. But there's a lot on Kelly on Global Research, and it is very, very important stuff. If anyone can conclude that he was, he committed suicide, they'd be pushing it. Don't forget that Kelly has had no inquest. He is unique in having had an unnatural death, died unnaturally, and had not having inquest. And that's why we battled on, why I went to the High Court in 2011, December the 19th, to ask permission for a judicial review of Grieve, who in opposition said we had a good case. When he came into power as Attorney General, he, in fact, refused, it was in his power, to direct that an inquest be held.
And would you just like to remind us how long the papers are apparently sealed for?
70 years. The lifetime of his three daughters. That's the thing. And a lot of it is sealed. Most of the avenues were blocked that we inquired into, including the police. Not all. But one, there's about three key things. The body was moved. You don't move bodies when you find them dead. The Hutton inquiry was set up by Blair from his jet traveling towards Tokyo from Washington within an hour of the corpse being found and before it was identified. Falconer called Hutton to his office to set up an ad hoc inquiry which had no powers of inquiry, no oath, no subpoena of witnesses, no ability to call a jury, and it's something else I've just forgotten, actually. But it was guaranteed. It was an ad hoc inquiry, and they added Section 17 on top of it.
So do you want to just pause for a second and see if you can remember what the last one was?
No cross-examination. So I'm 78 now, Tony. It's not easy. In fact, I find it's getting better again with the change of a drug that I've been given. But no cross-examination. So Hunt, the pathologist, who's only 2 years on the on the Home Office list as pathologist, he was called to the business. I wouldn't, if I was in charge of it, put, he's a reasonable chap, perhaps, but he was only 2 years on the list. He was 9 years qualified. I'd been doing 9 years of my surgical training before I became, we'll leave that, actually, but that's, the whole thing stinks. And one point, little point I could make now is that Kelly was very keen on having a cell phone with him. In his house, he had seven encrypted hard drives. He knew everything that was happening in Iraq, and he wanted to know what was going on. He was probably looking for, wanting to know about WMDs, which were non-existent, they found. But he had 700 encrypted hard drives. He used the cell phone a lot, I think. He went out for a walk at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, and no one saw him alive after that. In fact, he was seen alive by a farmer, but he withdrew the evidence. And a search party went out from his village to Southall. They never got called. But he had a cell phone with him, and you know very well that a cell phone emits a signal. Quite often, actually. I think within, not sure, it's probably every minute, I think. And the Oxfordshire is bristling with antennae. You can imagine, can't you? And you can imagine that they would be able to triangulate his position accurately. They could have proved suicide simply by saying Dr. Kelly left his house at 3 o'clock. He got to Harrowdown Hill at, say, an hour later. And he sat there contemplating suicide for the next 12 hours or something like that. But they showed nothing about his movements from the cell phone. The other thing is, he left the house at 3 o'clock. There was a maelstrom around him, a storm around him. And his family, the daughters were called, they did not inform the police that he was missing, even though he was much at risk, until 11:15 that day. 3 o'clock, 11:15, you can imagine what was going on, can't you? It's extraordinary.
That was South Dartmoor-based retired trauma surgeon David Halpin. And the book about the death of David Kelly, just out, is by Miles Goslett, G-O-S-L-E-T-T, and it's entitled An Inconvenient Death, How the Establishment Covered Up the David Kelly Affair. Priced around about £7.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined by V Townsend and Pamela Nowitzka from Animal Justice Emergency. But first with you, V, you had a pretty scary and horrible incident, didn't you, really, with NatWest? Just tell us how it all started.
Okay, 23rd of January, I phoned up NatWest for a loan for a vegan nutrition course. Not even 2 minutes into the phone call, I was told all vegans should be punched in the face. Basically, I said, my name's V Townsend, and I went, oh, nope, sorry, that's not the name, obviously, on my bank statements. And I explained why, and straight away, he was very aggressive, very upset and very passionate about what he was saying with regards to chalking where he lives. And that's basically activism where people just talk chalk messages, you know, go
in
vegan.
In the street?
Yeah. Go vegan, save animals.
So he thinks all vegans should be punched in the face because some vegans have been chalking messages on the streets near him.
Yeah, he told me it's vandalism as well, so I explained it's not vandalism because nothing's damaged, it's washed away.
And he
was getting very passionate telling me that it's forcing beliefs on people. So we're having a conversation and I said to him, okay, I said, so when you walk past a billboard, for example, then obviously you're reading what's on the advertisement and isn't that the advertisement, you know, forcing themselves
on
you.
Well, it is. What he's saying is true. Mm. What you're saying is true. So what did he have to say to that? Is that at the point at which he said all vegans should be punched in the face?
He said that before that, literally, within 2 minutes of the phone call.
You didn't put the phone down straight away then?
No, because I was shocked. To be honest with you, I wanted to get a loan and I only needed £400 at that time, which was declined because the least amount you can ask for is £1,000, which I didn't know. Anyway, so all that was going on. He was going on. Then he asked me if I own my property and I said no. I said, no, I don't. I said, I got myself insured. And I thought afterwards, why am I even explaining myself to you? And he said, well, I own my property. I would rather pay my mortgage than pay somebody else's, which it was just so nonsensical. It just didn't seem real in any shape or form.
Sounds like somebody who shouldn't be answering phones for NatWest. Do you know if he's been sacked yet?
I hope he wasn't. I did send a message. The first message, first of all, was basically saying, I don't want this gentleman to have, you know, I don't believe it's his fault at all.
Well, that's the thing. The tabloids would have been asking you straight away is, are you glad if he's been sacked?
No,
and you're saying, no,
no,
you're not.
No, not at all. Not at all. I didn't want that at all to happen. As far as I'm concerned, NatWest should have educated their staff. You know, the job I do in healthcare, sometimes I have to prepare a meal for someone and that goes against everything I stand for, but it's part of my job. I'm not going to tell them that I'm serving them a carcinogenic. I'm not going to tell them I'm giving cancer in a tin. You know, that's their choice to have those products. But he wasn't educated enough or wasn't properly prepped by NatWest in any way, shape or form. That was my argument. And every message I've had from NatWest, which I will show you, Tony, honestly, there are spelling mistakes. Even the last message they sent me, spelling mistakes after spelling mistakes.
Now, these banks are in quite a privileged position.
You'd think.
Being able to make money up out of nowhere, where some of us have to go begging on the streets in order to feed our families or to feed ourselves or to get a roof over our head for the night. You would have thought maybe that they would have a better calibre staff.
Yeah, or you think that they would pay the proper training for their staff, you know, regardless of who it is who wants to work for them. Fair play on every level of every person. But at the same time, NatWest need to put money and actually train their staff accordingly.
But anyway, saying all vegans should be punched in the face is a direct threat to you. Did NatWest, did you complain? What happened?
Well, at the end of the phone call, I did say to him, thank you very much for saying you want to punch my children in the face. And straight away he said, no, I didn't say that. I said, actually, you did, because my children are vegan. And the way I see it, which nobody said to me at all, he wants to hit children. Personally, I think that's extremely upsetting, extremely stressful.
So did you complain?
I did that night. I felt extremely uncomfortable. It was playing on my head a little bit. I spoke to my neighbour and they said that was wrong on too many levels. If it had been a religion, you know, I'm sure everything would have gone absolutely crazy. So I did write to NatWest and they phoned me straight away up the next day, the next morning. I didn't answer the phone and I sent them messages saying I would rather keep all correspondence through emails because they record their phone calls. I don't. I'm one person. They're a big company of 30,000
people.
That's
right. Very wise of you, yeah. Mm.
And kept it like that. And then fortunately, I've got some lovely, adorable friends who guided me towards the Vegan Society, and they were very helpful. And through going with the Vegan Society as well, Binman's, they're a solicitors in London. They were going through talks, were going pro bono for me. But I wanted to keep everything vegan. And if I'd have gone down that route, yes, okay, you could have had more money. But it's not about the money, is it? It's about raising awareness about veganism. And it wouldn't have been kept vegan. So
why
I chose not?
If you'd have,
I wouldn't have been a vegan solicitor. And then in the, I know it sounds funny to you, but that's how I see it. I really truly see it. So
Bindman's haven't got a vegan solicitor.
Not that I know of.
Did you actually fish around and try and find one?
I did ask. I phoned up and spoke to them as well, but they didn't get back to me.
Okay, so what did they give you? Some compensation? What?
They did, thank you very much. They gave me £1,000. I think it totaled sort of £1,075 and admitted that they were at fault with regards to the Human Rights Act legislation and equality. So
and was that after they got a letter from a solicitor or not? That was just
well, first of all, they lost the phone call, so the phone call had been totally lost, and it wasn't until
Freya
from the BBC contacted them and like, oh yes, we do have the phone call, and their total, you could see it in the letters, that it was as if different people were writing for them, the total misdemeanor change.
So who is this Freya at the BBC that seems to be able to work wonders?
A lovely lady who contacted me on Facebook and Instagram. She's seen the post I put on Bristol Vegans because I was just shocked that it happened, basically, and all these people, these messages, I was like, whoa. And she said a very wise thing, you know, if you don't want people, because I want to stay anonymous at the time because of my children and protect my children, she said, what you can do is if you take everything off of social media, then you'll be safe. And of course, in doing that as well, I was protecting her source, but that was a very good idea. And I do really appreciate that.
There's all sorts of, you know, ways to do these things. I mean, for example, if you get threats on social media, the obvious thing to do, and what they advise you to do, Facebook, Twitter, people like that, is to flag it, and then it gets deleted or it disappears. So you don't have the evidence. It's really important, I think, to be able to do screenshots of things and make sure you've
100%.
Got copies of everything. If you're going to delete it or ask YouTube or whoever to delete something, you've got copies of everything before that happens. Otherwise, you know, you could contact the police and they'll say, well, can you show us this? And they'll
proof.
Say,
yeah,
it's gone. It's all gone.
Yeah.
Anyway, so £1,000, that's not bad.
Yep, so it paid for just under 500 hours of my course, got me a laptop and had a couple of meals out as well.
And you got a bit of national coverage out of it.
Apparently so, yeah. My best one was NatWest wants to give vegan knuckle sandwich. That did make me giggle.
Okay. Well, we're also joined by Pamela Nowitzka from Animal Justice Emergency. How did you get involved with this, Pamela?
Well, I know V, and she was just sort of like asking for general support. So I was just trying to sort of like give her a bit of support, really, and sort of point her in the right direction with other friends, as you said, B. Mm. So, yeah.
Is it the first time you've come across someone being just so downright rude? Or maybe I'm wondering whether V is just the first person who, or one of the first people who's really stood up to them.
I think this is going to be an increasing problem as more and more people sort of like come out and are very sort of like open as vegans. There's bound to be a sort of like a backlash in the dominant culture, which basically is a speciesist culture, which tells us that human beings at the top of the apex of all life, and that we have the right to do whatever we want to do to other animals. So there's a lot of people that will feel very threatened by that, in the same way that people would feel threatened by years ago anti-racist comments and conversations and anti-sexist commentaries and stuff like that. People are feeling in the same way very threatened. Not everybody, but some.
What about, I mean, people do see animals treated very, very badly. I mean, for example, slaughterhouses are like cults. They're extremely secretive. No one is supposed to know what goes in. If you try and film in there, you have to get... There's a only way to do it would be, for example, to infiltrate the place and do secret filming to find out what goes on. And this is sort of out of sight, out of mind. So a lot of people are aware of that, but they would probably prefer, most would probably prefer to be a vegetarian and not go so far as veganism. So what is it that makes you go that extra mile? So not eating honey, not eating eggs, and maybe you could tell us what other things vegans, it separates vegans from vegetarians.
Sure, thanks for asking that question. It's a really useful question, because the thing about vegetarianism, it's just a concept. It's about what you eat, whereas being vegan is a moral belief, an ethical belief that we do, as human animals, should not use non-human animals in any way.
Well, a lot of vegetarians would say they're doing it for moral reasons.
Yeah, but they have a confused sort of like rationale, because it's okay for them to use the secretions of animals, milk and butter and cheese and all that sort of stuff, and eggs, which, you know, they come from the same concept of using animals, the same notion that we can do to other animals what we want, whereas vegans have the different attitude. We cannot use, we should not be using other animals.
Are vegans better than vegetarians?
Well, I think it's more morally consistent, and you can make up your own mind about whether or not you think it's better or not. Obviously, as a vegan, I'd say, you know, it's not about better or worse. It's about having thought something through, you know, having looked at the slaughterhouse videos, having looked at baby male chicks being macerated, being ground up alive, you know, having looked at the cows being sort of like artificially inseminated, having looked at the sort of like the videos of the blood and the pus, the allowable blood and the pus that comes out in the milk, you know, having looked at the cows that are sort of like only 5 years old when they're dragged off to the slaughterhouses, and seeing the baby calves who are separated from their mums crying and the mums running after them, they're separated by the farmers. You know, this is the reality. This is what vegans are saying. This is something we don't want to be part of. And this is why we would try and speak out to our vegetarian friends, as we would speak out to other non-vegans.
I mean, humans do it to each other too, don't they? In wars. I mean, I was reading some figures the other day, something like 3 million Muslims have been killed since the 9/11 attacks. Is there any way to sort of bring a halt to this other than everyone being vegan? Is that the only way?
Well, I think it's certainly a good moral baseline to start from. And you're talking about millions, 3 million of Muslims. And basically, you know, trillions of non-human beings are slaughtered every single year. That's trillions, not billions, not millions, trillions, for no good reason. And they die screaming, they die fighting, some of them die crying, actually, for no good reason. So I think we have to, you know, look at our own consciences and say, is this something I want to be part of? And you were absolutely right about the slaughterhouse things being like cults, because it's not just the slaughterhouses. The governments and the big industries are lying to us. They're torturing to death these trillions of living beings. And this death industry is destroying the planet. People are all concerned about, you know, XR and climate change and stuff like that. But the animal agriculture industry is destroying the planet, because 80% of the planet's surface, agricultural land, is used for animal agriculture, and that is the leading driver of biodiversity loss.
One of the other things I would add to all of this, you know, to I suppose agree with you really, is that in this country, which was the first to go through an industrial revolution, the first to go for mass urbanisation. We had the enclosures in the 1600s, mainly the 1700s was the biggest century of enclosures, people being kicked off the land who were mostly subsistence farmers. They were growing food and they may have a cow for milk, they might have a few sheep maybe, but actually the main activity was growing vegetables. That's what they did most of the year, and they used to do it in massive open fields called they were called the open fields, but it was a kind of gigantic allotment mm-hmm. around the village. Mm-hmm. That's the way Britain looked in medieval times. And interestingly, when that land was privatised and enclosed and the people were evicted from the land, being left to sleep in ditches and things like that, then what moved in? Sheep, mostly sheep. And the wool industry started off, and of course cattle. So that we go through our countryside, we go on a train, we drive through the countryside, and what we see isn't actually really a natural environment, is it?
Well, I don't think it is a natural environment anymore. And it's interesting because what you mentioned about sort of like the enclosures, my dad actually came over from Poland where he lived the life of a peasant. You know, his mum, she had half her house had the cow in it, and the family lived in, it was more like a shack really, and they had one sheep tied up in the sort of, as you say, like an allotment and stuff like that. And that's basically how most civilizations lived for sort of like, you know, until say the 1950s. That was the norm. And that sort of relationship with nature and with other animals is what we've lost, you know, in this whole sort of like, the whole sort of like neoliberal sort of like overconsumption, you know, market forces will solve everything.
We've got these new things as well now called mega farms, where they have literally thousands and thousands of cattle being milked on a mega farm and grown for just their own meat. I mean, I could certainly see your arguments, but how on earth will you change the minds of 60, 70 million people?
People's minds change all the time. People's mind, you know, culture is not static. I've already mentioned things like racism, like sexism, like transphobia, like homophobia. You know, a few decades ago, people would be like, oh no, you know, really slagging off sort of like people of colour or women.
But you're expecting people to survive on tofu?
Well,
I don't survive on just tofu.
Well,
goodness.
I mean, I had pizza today, you know, and it's not about the diet. It's not about the food. It's about the ethics and the morality. And most of the food that we eat can actually be veganized, you know. But, you know, it's about how you want to live your life. Do you want to be sort of like torturing innocent animals to death for no reason? Like, if they were cats and dogs, would you be happy torturing them to death to eat? You know, look at the Yulin Dog Meat Festival in China. People go berserk about that, you know, but it's okay to do it to sort of like billions of animals in the UK just because you don't see it. And there is actually tons and tons of footage up there on you know, my Facebook feed is full of sort of like animals being tortured to death. It's very, very upsetting, you know. And there's films, you know.
Are there any, I mean, sort of well-known, I can remember a long time ago, this would probably be early 1990s, when Channel 4 was quite new, they did a whole season called Banned, where they showed films which had been banned. And one of the evenings was a whole series of films shot in slaughterhouses. I just wonder if you know of any good, if you can call them good, these kind of... I mean, actually, they're a bit like snuff movies, aren't they? They're pretty horrific, but...
Oh, Land of Hope and Glory.
Dominion, I think, was one. But also, if you're looking at the environmental side, I think Cowspiracy is fantastic. And they've now bringing out a new one called Seaspiracy, which looks at the impact of the animal death industry on killing marine animals, which includes fish, and sort of like hundreds and thousands of dolphins and whales are killed as a byproduct of the fishing industry. The oceans are being decimated.
But when we go to our supermarkets and we buy whatever it is, £6 or £7 we spend on a big sirloin steak or something, it's all nicely packaged, isn't it? In a nice polystyrene.
How do you know that that's what it is? How do you know?
So it's nicely packaged, so what?
Well, so it doesn't look as if it's come from an animal, actually. It's just a package in a
Children think that as well, don't they?
That's part of what vegan advocacy is about. But, you know, the way that Animal Justice Emergency is looking at things is we need to tackle the institutional side of that. You know, look at the animal agricultural so-called industries. Look at the media that supports it. We live in a culture, a dominant culture, that says speciesism, treating other animals in any way that we choose to, is okay. And it's that dominant culture that needs to be addressed. And that's in a political sense as well, and in a legal sense as well. So, you know, these are big issues, and it is eminently doable. It's all doable.
What about fish? Can you eat fish?
Fish have feelings too. Fish have feelings too. They actually do. I mean, if you, you know, if we're friends on Facebook, I could share some stuff with you. Like, you know, some fish actually create a kind of like artwork at the bottom of the ocean. The puffer fish, in fact. They have relationships. The male seahorses look after the babies. Mm. They're very protective of each other.
I know squid are incredibly intelligent,
yeah,
aren't they,
yeah,
for example? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, human beings are not the apex of civilization.
Maybe some squid are more intelligent than humans.
Well, depends on which squid and which human, really, doesn't it?
What about the health thing, though? Because a lot of people would steer well away from it, saying, well, actually, this is going to be no good for my health at all. I need a bit of meat to survive.
I can say that about my daughter. I mean, we had to see the reasons that, you know, our family went down that path was my youngest, who you know, went to see cancer specialists. So we all had food allergy tests, you know, and lo and behold, we both were lactose intolerant as long, you know, with everything else. And I was allergic to a lot more things than my youngest, which totally shocked me. So from that point on, that was when I really looked into becoming vegan. And 3 months later, after going to the hospital, after having scans, after having x-rays, blah, 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 the lump in my youngest's neck vanished. So if it was a placebo, if it was just something that, you know, fine. But for me personally, my health, my hair's better, my skin's better, my energy levels, everything. I've not, you know, I'm 47 years old. I've never felt this good or energetic.
So it doesn't sound like it's done you any harm. What about the natural thing, though, Pamela? What about the idea that, I mean, we've got these incisors, haven't we? Our teeth. Aren't they for eating meat? Well, isn't that what we were designed for?
Do you know what, Tony? A lot of people do say that. And I'm not quite sure what planet they've sort of like beamed down from, because actually carnivores, my cats are carnivores, and my cats incisors are really long, and my cats have claws, and my cats can actually jump on things and kill them, actually. Now, with the best will in the world, you show me a human being that can jump on something, kill it with its claws and rip its insides out with its so-called canine teeth and eat it raw, and I will be really surprised.
So if you go to a plant-based diet, you can actually revert back, you know, diabetes. I mean, if you look at the numbers, say, for example, childhood diabetes before the 1980s, no matter what number you think of, it'll be lower. There were no cases that I believe, if there was, I hold my hands up and I apologise. But obviously, as processed foods have come on and people are continuously eating all these foods, type 2 diabetes is becoming more renowned, really, you know, everywhere, virtually everybody knows somebody who has type 2 diabetes. But from going on a plant-based diet, a vegan diet, that has been known on virtually every case to slow down, to stop, and even revert back to not even having type 2 diabetes.
Well, actually, it has to be a whole food plant-based diet.
A whole food?
Because you can eat vegan junk food.
And
fish and chips the other night at Matter.
Oh, that was delicious.
Really great, yeah.
So are there any good places to eat vegan food in the city?
Well, I would recommend Matter in Fish Pond Road, which has vegan fish and chips. We just had the
lovely,
most amazing.
Yeah. Coms as well on King Street.
I don't know about them, but Matter, what do I have? The banana fish or something or other.
It was
just divine.
Unbelievable.
And so what was this other one you were talking? What was the other one you were talking about?
We've got Kong's, which is on King Street. That's
food. What about that pizza place? Taste of Napoli.
Yeah, you can find it difficult to get a pizza with
and
no
you've
cheese.
Got the coconut
it's
tree.
Vegan cheese.
Tasty. Amazing. I can even make my own vegan cheese.
You can even get vegan cheese in Tesco.
Okay, so obviously there is sort of vegans do get together in the city. Where and how? And if people are interested more, where should
join
they go?
Bristol Vegans.
And there's Animal Justice Emergency. We're on Facebook.
Yeah.
And also we're giving a talk at the House of Veg, which is a new vegan street food event on April the 13th at the Pennywell Project in Pennywell Lane, organised by a really nice bloke called Dan. And we'll be giving a talk and a workshop there. So it's all sort of like loads of stalls with vegan street food and also vegan products that you can buy. That's April the 13th. House of Edge.
Okay, Pamela Nowitzka from Animal Justice Emergency and V Townsend, Smiter of NatWest. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. It was fun.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, David Halpin, and also Pamela Novitska and V Townsend. Also to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you've some of your precious spare time to spare, volunteer with us or have hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Le money, il sur le tableau. Il money, le money sur le tableau. Sir, the palace of excess leads to the palace of excess. Feel so alive. Hey! Oh, yeah. It's a love song. I've lost the music. I feel so alive. I quit, but my turn to fire.